You're listening to a special presentation brought to you exclusively by Radio Free Readout.
Our first speaker is Pat Seymour from Project Appleseed. Project Appleseed is an activity of the Revolutionary War Veterans Association, a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to teaching every American our shared heritage and history, as well as traditional rifle marksmanship skills. Their volunteer instructors travel across the country teaching those who attend about the difficult choices, the heroic actions, and the sacrifices that the founders made on behalf of modern Americans, all of whom are their posterity. Welcome, if you will, with me, Pat Seymour from Project Appleseed.
Good afternoon. I always like to open my shoots by recognizing the veterans in the audience, and there's many of you out there today. So on behalf of the National Project Appleseed, but especially our Northwest instructor cadre, I'd like to thank you for your service. And because of that service, we enjoy the liberty that we have today to be here. Now, for those that have, I got to step off for the mic for a minute because this is going to get loud. Repeat after me, and for those that have been to an Appleseed, pretend you don't know anything about Appleseed, but I need three huzzahs really loud. One, two, three. Huzzah! 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 That's what the citizens of Lexington heard on this morning, 239 years ago, as the white smoke of hundreds of musket shots cleared. As the King regulars cheered their victory with those huzzas, the colonists began to tend to their wounded and mourn their dead. The once peaceful grass of Lexington's Common is covered in the blood of their kin. Eight militiamen lay dead or dying, another nine wounded. Of the eight sets of fathers and sons present in Captain Jonathan Parker's militia company, five of them are separated by death. The King's men, they suffer only one minor casualty. Can you imagine how our ancestors felt about these soldiers who came into their town and without provocation slaughtered and maimed 17 men, neighbors, brothers, uncles, fathers and sons. But this is not the last exchange of musket fire on April 19th. Confiscation of the colonial arms at Concord is the ultimate goal, along with the arrest of the rebels Samuel Adams and John Hancock. Now, Concord was warned by one of Paul Revere's alarm riders, a Dr. Samuel Prescott, early in the morning of April 19th. As such, Concord begins to muster their militia out in front of Wright's Tavern. Now, the militia in this time period is composed of all able-bodied men from the ages of 15 to 50. And as they meet, they decide, what is it they're going to do this day? The youngest ones, those of the minute companies, which comprise about a quarter of the militia, they're gung-ho, and they want to meet the regulars head-on, well before they ever set foot into their town. The main body of the militia prefers to wait in town and take up defensive positions. But the alarm list, the older gentlemen, the ones that have seen battle before, veterans of the French and Indian Wars, they think it would be wisest to retreat and wait till their numbers grow. But remember, this is New England. We see how they vote and how they move. They don't make much for decisions. Each group does their own thing, and the Minutemen proceed to head east out of town. They get about a mile away, and they crest the first hill, and they get the first glimpse of a British regiment heading down the road. 800 to 900 regulars in formation, bayonets gleaming in the morning sunlight. Boy, that's a lot of them. There's not a lot of us. They decide that their elders are indeed smarter and wiser. And in a very orderly retreat, complete with fife and drum, they turn around and double time it back to Concord. Back in Concord, the militia and the alarmist still have not decided what to do, but upon hearing that the regulars are just down the road now, less than a mile, they decide they do need to retreat out of town. They cross the North Bridge and gather on the muster field. Here on the muster field, Colonel Barrett, leader of the Middlesex Militia, confers with his other company commanders, and they decide that, yes, they should retreat, and they go up to the top of a little hill called Punkatasset Hill to wait until their numbers are equal to that of their enemies. About this time, Colonel Smith, the leader of the British regiment, rolls into Concord, begins searching. There's no warrants here. They just start going through farms looking for military supplies. He secures the bridges in and out of town, two companies guarding each bridge, and sends an additional four companies of light infantry to Barrett's mill and home and farm. Barrett, remember, is the colonel of the local militia lead. And the Tory spies have told the regulars that Barrett's has a large cache of supplies. They've also told them there's some cannon stationed around somewhere close to the Wright's Tavern. Ephraim Jones is the tavern keeper. Jones figures, I'm going to bar the door. They won't be able to think anybody's home, and they'll just go on by. So he bars the door. He's probably sitting there having a cup of coffee. They thunder the door. No one answers. The grenadiers are big guys. They're not infantry. They're big. They blow through the door, knock it down, demand from Mr. Jones, where are the cannon? Mr. Jones, cannon? What cannon? I know nothing of such. They wrestle him to his knees. The officer in charge draws his horse pistol, cocks it, places it to its head, and say, you will tell me where the cannon are, or this is your last day. Oh, those cannon. Now I remember. The building adjacent to Wright's Tavern is a county building. It holds a jail. They have a shared yard in the back. The yard is kind of what we might call a dump of today. It has some old wagons in there, some dilapidated farm equipment, and the cannon are kind of rat-holed in various corners with some stuff piled over them, brush, old implements. They were just too big and too heavy to move or bury. This is it. This is the sole things the regulars find in Concord. But the grenadiers, they roll these cannon out, and they break off the trunnions. Now, the trunnions, those are those ears on the side of the cannon barrel that allows cannons to be elevated and aimed. Without cannon or without trunnions, those cannon tubes are little more useless than a pipe with a plug in the end. So now we have some three useless cannons, and they break up the carriages and the wheels, and they start a bonfire. The bonfire quickly spreads to the town meeting hall. The town forms a bucket brigade to put this fire out. And a little old lady goads about half a dozen of these big, hulking, red-coat grenadiers into joining the bucket brigade. Interesting. Not really at war yet, are we? But due to Revere's warning the week before on August 8th, this cannon's it. It's the sole supplies that the regulars are able to find. So let's head back to the North Bridge for a minute. We have a couple companies of light infantry regulars awaiting the return of the search party from Barrett's. As they look up the hill, they see some colonial militia start working their way towards them. The militia are leaving Punkatasset Hill to return to the muster field. From the muster field, they can see smoke rising from town. A brash young lieutenant goes up to Colonel Barrett and says, "Sir, do you intend to let them burn the town down?" One of the captains, Captain Smith, says, "My men are prepared to drive the regulars from the bridge." But Captain Isaac Davis from Acton draws his sword and says, "I haven't a man amongst us who is afraid to go." Isaac Davis, an interesting man. He was a gunsmith and a blacksmith from the small town of Acton. Typical of the militia of its day, their officers are elected by those that serve. So he's obviously highly respected, a veteran. He took great pride in training his local company. They trained twice a week behind his shop. Because he was a blacksmith, he was able to outfit them with bayonets, which was a rarity amongst the militia. And they also had cartridge boxes, so they would have pre-measured loads ready to go, quicker to reload and fire. Isaac Davis was warned, as a captain in the militia, he would have been a primary stop for the alarm riders, and as he was gathering his gear, making ready for the day, he had things to do. He had a wife, her name was Hannah. He had four children. All four of his children were sick with what today we would call scarlet fever. Neither Isaac nor Hannah thought the children would live through the next day. Hannah would later write, as Isaac was preparing to leave, he approached the door, stopped, turned around, and then just looked like he was going to say something profound, but simply said, "Take good care of the children." As Isaac left, the last thing he probably heard was the sound of those four sick children crying. But I have to think, the sound of his country crying must have been even louder. Colonel Barrett, meanwhile, at the muster field above the bridge, is reddering the troops, reminds the men of the order of the day, not to fire unless fired upon, but then to fire as fast as you can. Butcher Barrett's hope is to move across the North Bridge without engaging the regulars. The regulars now are ordered to fall back across the bridge. They also receive an order for a few of them to fire a volley into the river, the volley to show that they are indeed loaded with ball and not blank. The militia can see the splashes in the water. They know what's going on, but they still keep coming down the hill. They're in a long, winding, two-rank line with a course. Isaac Davis is Acton militia in the lead because they're better outfitted and probably better trained. As the regulars are ordered to fall back across the bridge, they start tearing up a few of the planks. But Major John Buttrick, who is Barrett's second in command and leader of the complete Minuteman component, yells at the top of his lungs,
"Hey, what do you think you're doing? That's our bridge."
Astounded, the regulars actually leave the planks alone. And they're given orders to form up in what's called a street fighting formation. Now, a street fighting formation is a long, narrow form where only the front ranks fire. And when they're empty, they peel to the back, reload, and it progresses up. This is likely an effective form if you're fighting in an alley or a street. But this is open countryside. I don't think it's going to work too good. As the Colonials come down the hill, they're in a sweeping two-by-two line, and they have clear fields of fire down on the bridge. They're getting closer, and all of a sudden, there's a shot, quickly followed by two more, and then a ragged volley, and the whole front rank of the regular troops opens fire. And this is the same indiscipline that they showed early in the day at Lexington. Captain Isaac Davis is hit in this first volley and killed instantly. Private Abner Hosmer also hit and killed. Several others are wounded. The colonists are now just 50 yards from the bridge. As men begin to fall around him, Major John Buttrick yells, "Fire, fellow soldiers! For God's sakes, fire!" And fire they do. But unlike the regulars, they aim first. 4 of the 8 regular officers are killed in this first volley. You have to remember, our colonial militia were trained to shoot the officers first. And the officers were very distinct in these days because they took great pride in having the reddest of the red coats. And remember, if you look at the pictures of the old regular uniforms, their cartridge boxes were worn on right bandoliers, which did a really nice cross right over the center of the chest. The regulars now find themselves in a trap. With most of their officers gone, no one's controlling the street fighting formation. They're not giving coherent orders. They panic and begin to bolt back to Concord in fear for their lives. This is a rare spectacle in military history. To see the forced, famed for indomitable courage, beaten by colonial militia composed of farmers, shopkeepers, merchants. This is the first time the colonists have been ordered to fire upon the regular troops, and the very first time colonials have killed the king's soldiers. Now, flush with success, discipline on the colonial side breaks down. Many think the day is over and it's off to home they go. It's April. There's fields to put in. It's been a long winter. All these guys got a lot of work to do. Many leave. But there's one final incident at the bridge that's going to prove important later in the day. As the regulars fled towards the village, a young man who was mentally unfit for colonial militia duty enters that road, and he's carrying a hatchet. He comes across a wounded regular laying in the road, raises his hatchet, cracks open his skull, and exposes the brains of this helpless soldier. Remember now, Colonel Smith still got a whole bunch of troops still in Concord. He hears the gunfire coming from the bridge and leads 2 companies of grenadiers to see what's going on. On his way, he meets the 2 companies of infantry in a rather haphazard, ragged bunch running towards him. He knows he's got 4 more companies on the other side of the bridge without a way back. Above the bridge, Colonel Barrett finally regains control of the colonial militia. He divides his forces. He keeps the alarm list and the militia with him up on the hill, and he sends Major Buttrick and all the Minutemen across the bridge, has them deploy behind a stone wall. Great field of fire, not bad cover. Buttrick readies his forces, tells them to hold fire until he gives the command, but then to fire 2 or 3 times before retreating. Smith and his grenadiers approach the bridge and halt about 200 yards away. Colonel Smith observes the strength and steadiness of the opposing forces and reluctantly orders the grenadiers back to Concord. About this time, those 4 companies that were searching Barrett's, again unsuccessfully, everything had been moved or extremely well hidden. They approach the bridge, and they see what's going on, and they break and run across the bridge as fast as they can for fear of being cut off. They pass directly under Barrett's muskets on the hill, around the corner off the bridge, and go by all of Buttrick's muskets behind the stone wall. The New England men hold their fire, still reluctant to engage the king's soldiers without being directly fired upon. After crossing the bridge, the regulars come across the wounded soldier that was brained with the hatchet. Instantly, word spreads among them that the colonials are murdering prisoners and torturing the wounded. Many regulars had long felt contempt for the New England Yankees, but now a serious hatred begins to grow. This atrocity would lead to many others committed by both sides later this day. It's shortly after midday in Concord, not much different than right now, and the regulars begin retracing their steps. They got to get all the way back to Boston. Colonel Smith and his officers observe the colonial militia that's up on the hills. They have an 18-mile-long gauntlet to face to make it back to Boston. They started the day with only 36 rounds. They've used a good bit of that already. It's going to be a long afternoon. But Smith is no rookie. He's seen battle before, and he's been an effective battlefield commander. He knows what he's got to do. He sends out flanking parties south of the road to the river to keep the militia off of those stone walls and those farm buildings. He sends other flanking parties north of the road up to a low ridge that parallels the road. No fire can be put on this road once these flankers are out. This is extremely effective till they get to a place called Miriam's Crossing, Miriam's Corner. The topography changes a bit here. There's several county roads that come into Miriam's. Colonial militia that have been warned through the alarm riders have been en route all night long, coming from all over Massachusetts and Connecticut. At this point, there's over 1,000 of them meeting at Miriam's Corner. And for the first time on April 19th, colonial forces outnumber the regulars. The other thing that happens here, you all know what happens when you have a really long line of folks marching and you come to a really narrow bridge. Well, that ridge that his flankers was on, it also ends and comes to the same pinch point, as does his flankers that were clear to the river, because the river's come in now. So now you've slowed up the main body of troops to probably less than half speed. But guess what's behind them? It's colonial militia walking down the same road that they're on, and they're not slowing down. The rear guard of the Redcoat Brigade is a little worried. They raise their muskets, and they fire. One must remember the commands of the British Army of those days were, ready, fire. What's missing? Aim. Again, they fire high, hit nothing. But there's 1,000 militia in front of them, behind stone walls, behind farm buildings, behind homes. They see their brethren being fired upon. They don't wait. They fire upon the front ranks of the regulars, and they take out some more officers and some more men. About 12 drop before the regulars can get through this pinch point. They've taken a huge hit in their officer corps. But what's notable here is this is the first time the colonial forces have fired on the regulars in a non-defensive action. The final strike of the revolutionary match is made, and this time it blazes forth and burns brightly, igniting the fuse of war for independence that will last 8 bloody years and cost thousands of lives. There were 56 signers of that traitorous document that we know today as the Declaration of Independence. 5 were captured by the British, and tortured before they died. 12 had their homes ransacked and burned. 9 fought and died from their wounds or hardships incurred in the Revolutionary War. They truly sacrificed. What would they think of our predicament and us? How would they respond? Do we dare fail? So long as we remember what the founding generation sacrificed when they made this choice, and so long as we maintain the freedoms that they secured in our stead, then they are not gone. Their struggle was not in vain. However, should we fail to do as they instructed and maintain our freedom by participating in the political process they handed down to us, then we do not deserve our freedom, and we will surely lose it. You have an obligation to those that fought for you before and to those who will follow you. What will your choice be? So if you need to hear about what led up to Lexington or what happened after Concord, come to an Appleseed or come to one of our Liberty Seeds. We'll be happy to tell you more history. Thank you.